Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkenberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And for our listeners who cannot get enough of useless math, have we got a podcast for you?
I don't know that it's entirely useless, but we did get a question that was, to summarize it, is I'm working on establishing a reliability target based on lowest total cost. And that there's a tool in a software package to remain unnamed, but I think most of you will figure it out pretty quick, that does the calculation. So I'm leveraging that tool and provided a link. And it provides a, you have to input some information. So part of it is kind of going on warranty. So what's your lost sales? And you come up with a expected reliability for this undesigned product as of yet, because you're just setting the goal. And you have a Weibull curve for it. And apparently that's going to give us some factor of, you know, warranty costs. I think that's what it's doing. Mm-hmm. And then there's production cost, you know, how much does it cost you to make one of these things, and stuff like that. And then it has, you know, basically what's your return on investment, you know, and it's at the face of it, it to me, it's, if you've got really great information about your market share or how this new product will fit into the mix, and your competitors aren't going to do anything, and which, let me get it, not get ahead of myself, but if you know what your future market share is and you have a pretty good guess of what your future product returns will be, then you could say, all right, if we increase the reliability or decrease the reliability, we can optimize the warranty cost. And I don't know how warranty cost goes up, or why that wouldn't be, just make it as low as possible. But I think they're banking on that to make it more reliable costs more. And so it's like, yeah, we don't really know that until we've designed the thing. So it's like, but anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. And I sent you the link, so you had a quick look at it while I'm jabbering away here.
Yeah, I mean, all right. So firstly, I suppose my answer can be given at the start. I think it's awful what this is. And the idea is that it's not unusual to have business or engineering problems attempted to be described by a fundamentally mathematical relationship for the purpose of then turning it into a university exercise to go find what the right numbers are. And the problem with these sorts of activities is that the number of assumptions and leaps that need to be made to create these equations in the first place are incredulous at best, which means that even if you do the subsequent optimization perfectly, then you're still modeling, or it's based on a system which doesn't represent how the real world works. And just for listeners, there's some key equations here. The idea is that you start off with working out your total market value for your product, which is the maximum market potential multiplied by the best market unit sale price. So if you're making a radio, your total market value would be the total number of radios that people, every person in the world purchases, multiplied by what you think the best price for that would be. So if it's 1 million radios across the world and each radio, the best market unit sale price is $14, then the market total market value is 14 million. So that's the
There's just a few assumptions in there, isn't there?
Well, yeah. I mean, I can actually run with that one, maybe because it's sitting next to some other assumptions which make whatever assumptions went into that one seem trivial.
Okay.
Because the next one is that the function for market share is a function of reliability. So this is, it uses the cumulative distribution function of the Weibull distribution, which is where the independent variable is reliability, to then divine a number between 0 and 1, which represents the market share for your hypothetical radio, if it is it has a given reliability.
You know, and there is a subtle intuitive or wishful thinking that if I make it more reliable, I'll get more market share. And it is a factor, it is a purchase decision, it's one of the factors. For some products, it's more important than others. But right. I don't really care about a ballpoint pen that I want next to the refrigerator, you know, when I'm writing down stuff to put on the shopping list. I don't make that purchase decision based on how reliable that pen is. I just buy two, being a reliability engineer, and I have a backup.
But even if you reliability was an issue, well, it's saying that the only thing that customers will take into consideration is reliability.
I saw a report on white appliances like refrigerators, washing machines, stuff like that in Europe. And they listed, I think, 15 or so considerations that customers cited as these are things we think about. You know, will it fit? Will it do the job? You know, is it functional? Is it low energy? Or is it, you know, all these other factors? And reliability was often cited as important, yet the other ones all could trump it. If it doesn't fit in your apartment, you're not going to buy it.
Well, let's not even think about just engineering or physical challenges. What about marketing? I mean, there are plenty of devices out there which have exceeded the value and usability of competitors, but they're just better marketed.
Yeah.
And so get higher market share as a result. And that, I mean, we could keep brainstorming engineering and non-engineering things, distribution. I mean, yes.
Why would it be compatibility versus anything else?
Yes. To say this is just a function, the number of units you can sell is just going to be a function of its reliability. And we haven't even talked about the ability to convince customers that the reliability you claim is the true reliability.
Yeah.
It could have a 99.999% reliability, but how do they know that's the reliability of your device compared to another device which might have on the packaging the same number, but is not? It's just, anyway, so that's, let's call that issue number one. And realistically, it's a family of issues. So we'll call them family of issues number one. The whole idea that you market share is simply a function of reliability. And secondly, if you do assume that it is a function of reliability and nothing else, why the Weibull distribution? Why?
Yeah, it's flexible. And it could be completely inappropriate for whatever your final product is. It's most likely a mixture of distributions.
Right. And then the next thing is that those parameters used for the Weibull distribution to describe your estimated market share, those parameters are now used in another equation, which is, I have seen a couple of times generically, but essentially the beta parameter multiplied by Euler's number to the power of the life or characteristic life parameter multiplied by R, that's apparently your sales price. Huh. Now, I could be mistaken in that these are just simply those parameters are supposed to be particular to each equation. But again, let's just say they are. Where is the proof that the sale price as a function of reliability is equal to some constant B multiplied by E to the power of A times R? Now, that's the assumption number three. Now, this is completely debunkable because most optimization problems require this annoying little thing called coherence. And coherence can be applied across to mathematics. And long story short, it's that everything behaves logically. Now, we have talked about case studies where companies have actually been able to invest in creating a reliability culture which has this wonderful effect of actually reducing time to market and reducing production costs. So somewhat counterintuitively to a good chunk of the troglodytes out there is that you can actually make something which is more reliable for less money and take less time to do it. So straight away, this equation here, which constrains reliability, or any increased reliability to increase sale price, is debunked. And even if it wasn't debunked, at no stage has there been any proof that this equation is anywhere close to reality. So that's issue number three.
I think we step through every one of these things and find something in it. And it goes with a number of other equations that they put a couple of lines together and they say, all right, when you minimize costs and maximize sales, you get the most profit. And it's like, okay, it's magic. It's totally don't use it. It was my first comment back to the question poser. And I find that just the idea that you can pull up a tool in a software package and pull in some of the assumptions that you got, it is, in my mind, one of the considerations. You know, will anybody buy this, independent of the equation that we're assuming, at some price point? And then two, how reliable does it need to be? Or do we expect it to be? And it's kind of, to me, it struck me as circular logic. Aren't we setting the target as opposed to assuming it right from the start and then, right, and then pull off a number off of it? We don't really know what it is yet.
Let's not even forget that you look at the car industry in the 1950s, the typical warranty period for a car was 3 months. Yeah. And this, as of right now, it's not unusual for 10-year warranties to be offered for at least drivetrains and things like that. Yeah. And so reliability at what point in time? So
yeah. And what's your market? I mean, the things that strike me is it's missing what I think are as or more important. And whenever I've been involved with a target setting discussion, I don't think anybody pulled out a slide ruler or a calculator or a spreadsheet or a software package. It was marketing was involved. The technical folks were involved. Marketing was doing their research and study and saying, you know, this is why we need to make this product. And here's the feature sets and what customer needs are. And it's coming with an understanding of what problem is this thing trying to solve and how much is that worth to the buyer? And then backing off from that with brand promise and competitive research, what else, other solutions are available at price points, and all kinds of factors get involved in just the marketing side. The technical guys have it pretty easy. They look at it and go, well, that's impossible. You know, we can't make a lightning proof handheld wristwatch with any known materials that we have today. So no, it's impossible, kind of thing. Or they go, oh, yep, we think we only need to come up with 14 miracles to design this. But yeah, that's more in the realm of we'll give it a try. Or this is really close to current solutions. We know this technology. We know this material sets. We know this. We know how to do that. You know, and that's just two of the organizations, but you also need, you know, the risk management part of portfolio considerations. And are we really, is this worth selling? Is it, what's the downside if we sell it, especially in the US where we have too many lawyers? And on and on and on. It's not a simple figure out the reliability and you answer all your rest of your questions.
It's a little bit lost for words. It's just crazy. It's just, all this does is give someone the ability to create a report that is difficult to challenge because it's got some equations in there. And a lot of decision makers will just simply look at reports. Okay, see, there's an equation in there. Clearly, someone put some thought in that equation that didn't just pop out of thin air. In this case, it just did. I'm trying to find on this link you sent me any suggestion that this is based on any sort of observation of real-world stuff. And based on my real world stuff, real world observations, and we like one example, we you and I both know there are organizations out there who've managed to improve reliability and reduce sale price in doing so. It's been a joint venture, so to speak.
But well, I also have run into organizations that it was one marketing study, and I know I've talked about it on this show a couple of times, is that they found a correlation that between the perceived reliability of the product, and it's part marketing, it's part the customer's experience with previous products. So their trust in the brand is the way they phrased it most. So if they have a 1 point increase in brand trust that it's going to be reliable, that equated to some number percentage point increase in market share. And they were able to show the value of that step increase in market share versus the what the perceived reliability was. And that was prior to social media. So I'd be very, very curious how, you know, a single bad review on some social media platform would damage a brand in that kind of a study or survey kind of thing. Whereas there used to be that if you had a bad product, the marketing people are telling me, if you have a great product, they'll tell one person, you know, when the situation comes up, oh yeah, try this, it's really good. But if they have a bad product, they'll tell everybody at the Thanksgiving dinner. And so they'll tell 10 people that they had this bad experience. I think the bad side of that just got multiplied over the last 10, 15 years. And
yeah,
so the equation doesn't quite, or that old, you know, lore or wisdom doesn't really apply as strongly as it used to. But
it doesn't also.
Yeah, go ahead.
So yeah, I was going to say that there's also people buy things like you're not buying a Jaguar car for reliability. You're not.
Yeah,
everyone knows it.
Although they do have repair centers in almost every town in the country, so, you know.
And they do very well.
Yeah.
But everyone knows that Jaguars have historically been unreliable cars. No, that is a referenceable fact. But people aren't buying Jaguars because they are reliable. They're expensive vehicles. They should be way more reliable than they currently are. They're not. Jaguar doesn't really care too much about it because that's not what they're trying to sell to their clients.
Status symbol, if nothing else.
Right. In fact, the biggest story with Jaguar recently has been the change of their logo.
Oh, they got so much blowback on that. I was just, what are you thinking?
but exactly, because it's all about an image. People are buying it for an image, and a logo change, which is not consistent with what people think the image is when they're driving a Jaguar car, is going to be huge. But let's call it the more mainstream. No one would really bat an eyelid if Toyota changed the logo on their cars. No, I don't think anyone would.
Not really, no.
No, people aren't going to boycott Toyota if they change their logo, or Hyundai or other, you know, relatively reliable vehicles. And so Jaguar was selling something different. And these equations, if they were applied to a Jaguar car with Jaguar reliability, well, the calculator. Well, the calculator would explode.
Yeah, well, there's that. But let's just spend a minute or so on. So, how do you set a reliability goal? To me, in summary, it would be there's technical constraints, there's financial constraints, and there's a timeline. And what can the team, it's not an individual and an equation. It's what does this team think we can achieve? And let's write that down. And go ahead and work on it. If we have to change that because we learned something in the process, we can change it and then see what the effects are on all the other pieces that reliability does touch that we know about. But treat it like it is. It's an unknown. It's a goal or a target or aspiration. And if we have a history of, say, a family of products and we're doing our 15th iteration of that product, we have a bunch of information about market share and failure rates and technology and everything else. So we might be pretty knowledgeable about how that particular new product is going to behave and where we want to focus our attention related to reliability. But there's too many factors to model it in a coherent way, in my opinion. So that's kind of my short summary. How would you set the goal, Chris?
Well, I mean, this goes back to what the customer uses to make the decision. So in this case, it's talking about free market, so to speak. It's not talking about a customer approaching a producer with specifications in hand. That's clearly part of this scenario. So what do you and I use to judge the reliability of stuff that we look at in a shop that we walk into where we don't know anything about technologically? Usually it's just the warranty period. That's how we compare one product to another.
Yep. So what's their perceived trust in their own product?
Right. So if two products have a 1-year warranty, for me, their reliability performance in my mind is indistinguishable. That's the only information I have about them. And you rationally think, well, if they were reliable enough to offer longer warranty periods, they would. So they're not. So these two products have similar reliability characteristics. Conversely, if you have a product which has a 1-year warranty period and the one sitting next to it, which is functionally similar but has a 2-year warranty period, now we're starting to think about, okay, so this is more reliable. That really does influence people's decision-making. So very first thing is let's get off this reliability thing in terms of and don't treat customers as walking optimization-solving algorithms. They're going to look at a couple of features fleetingly before they make the decision. And it's going to be usually something like warranty period and not much else. And so start with the warranty period and you go, okay, so if the warranty period is this, because as a rule, if you get into the market, you know what most of your competitors are offering. So if everyone else is offering a 1-year warranty period, you better not be the only one that offers a 6-month warranty period.
Yep.
So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that, all right, so when do we start losing money? When do we start eating to our profit margin based on warranty failures? And you should be able to work that out. So you got the recommended retail price, you got the replacement cost for warranty, which is often it's pretty close to the recommended retail price, but it's usually, you know, for example, if you got a 10% margin on your product and your recommended retail price is $100, that means you make $10 profit on that sale and therefore $90 to produce that thing. And so to replace one, it costs $90. So you know how much it's going to cost.
Plus shipping, plus paperwork, plus call centers, plus. The guideline I recommend is 2.5 times retail price when you get into the details of phone calls and time troubleshooting and failure analysis and, you know, some companies do their repairs and stuff like that, depending on the market, of course, and type of product. It you can figure out to some extent those things. And then the more history you have with the similar products, the better you'll get at it. There's no doubt.
I want to go back to your
first one, though, is, you know, the purchase decision. If it's your second time into the store and you want to buy that, I'm looking at an inkjet printer across my room here going, that, well, it's been on the shelf here for good 15 years. And I know it only has a 5-year warranty. And it still works. And I happen to know part of the design process of these products is I work creating inkjet printers. And they do.
Always printing with you, isn't it?
Yeah. And well, I've got a lot of experience in it. And the discussion of reliability targets and stuff came in to play because they really wanted it to last a long time because they didn't make money selling the hardware. They made money selling the ink, because anybody recently purchasing ink cartridges would know. But the idea was that it's not the warranty that's going to be my consideration now. It's the brand reputation is I have had this printer, and I think I had one in my office when I was, you know, in the corporate world that were HP printers, and they just worked. I didn't have to reboot them. I didn't have to load new firmware in them every time I turned around. I didn't have to, you know, they just worked. And this one's been working for 15 years. If it's very, very likely that if I walked into a big box store to buy another printer, I'd go straight to the HP one that's very similar to the one I got now. And if I even bothered to look, that they're only offering a 3-month warranty in it, I would really go buy the competitors. I would back up to, no, there's something seriously changed here, but I bet you it's still 5 years. But the idea is that the brand, if you meet or exceed the customer's expectation for it, and I'm using air quotes, just working for their, not the warranty period, but for how long they think it should work, they're very much more likely to go buy the same brand. And so that's where I think high reliability with customer experience really pays off, is that
you
get hooked into that brand.
I concur, but it feels like the premise of someone asking this question or using these equations is that it feels a lot to me like someone's entering the market, like they've got no history. They haven't been selling their inkjet printers for decades the way Hewlett Packard has.
Yeah,
they don't have a really good idea of what those recommended retail prices or sales costs are. And so they're Googling, what the hell do I charge? So for me, I don't disagree. It just sounds like that would be something which doesn't apply to the person asking this question.
Yeah, no, I the exchange of messages didn't really get into that. But my basic premise, my basic response was, no, there's way too many assumptions and it's missing too many factors. Get the knowledgeable folks around a table. What are the constraints? What are the boundaries? What's possible? And pick a number and adjust it as you learn more information. There's nothing wrong with that. It's not a fixed number that never, ever can change, especially if you're doing it internally. If it's given by a customer and that's the only reason you're developing this product, that's different. But it's basically, is it technically feasible? Is it financially sellable? Is it, you know, meet a customer need? Well, let's pick a number. How long do people typically want this item to work? Well, there's a target. There's a duration for you. Well, how many should last? Well, what's the cost to the customer if it fails? Not the cost to us as the company manufacturing it. That's a secondary feature. And then throw out a number and say, can we make that? And then learn as you go and adjust. But yeah, going to this tool and creating a fancy plot is, I think, dangerous.
Also, going back to the warranty period I was talking about, you know, when you have those people sitting down, when I facilitate for me is I often have, okay, what's the warranty period that we're going to offer? Mm-hmm. And it's usually a pretty good idea about what that is.
Mm-hmm. The duration anyway, yeah.
Yeah, the warranty period. So say it's 2 years. And they go, okay, do you guys have any plans at all to try and increase that warranty period? And then often they will say, yeah, we'd love to be able to offer a 3-year warranty period, but it's going to happen sometime in the future. Okay, that's cool. So what we'll do when we do the FEMIA is I always have tailored occurrence scales for each one in my occurrence workshop. So one of those levels will be, you know, likely failure or probable failure during the warranty period. The next one will be likely / probable failure during the aspirational warranty period. So straight away, we're starting to think about, you're forcing people to think about, okay, so yep, it's really bad if it fails during our 2-year warranty period, but we're going to actually sort of penalize things if they fail during the 3-year aspirational warranty period, because you know what? Who knows? Maybe at the end of this FEMIA, we are prioritizing those failure modes and mechanisms which will ruin our day within 3 years. Maybe, just maybe, we can actually go to market with a 3-year warranty period. Yep. Because we believe we're confident enough that we have designed those 3-year failures out. But, oh, man, this is...
That's a pretty decent idea. I like that. I wish I had known that a few times. Ah, good for you and good for your clients. That's a neat idea. But anyway, we've rambled on about this, what I thought would be a simple question, but of course not.
Well, simple answer is it's don't do it.
Yeah, yeah, just don't do it. But this was a LinkedIn question that we got, and I went back and forth a couple of times through messaging on that, and hopefully made a similar enough point to what we talked about here. And thank you, Chris, for diving into the math a bit and going, what in the world is going on here, and explaining that. But if you've got a question, you can, you know, spark a conversation like this, but you also get an answer back, or you get some comments or feedback right away. So if you're wondering about, you know, setting reliability targets or something else related to reliability or quality and stuff like that, let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. There's a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Chris and I and the other hosts of the show are available through LinkedIn, as this question came in via, and also on our about pages on Ascendo Reliability. So plenty of ways for you to get in touch with us. And I'm not going to go buy a printer because I printed something this morning and it worked flawlessly. So I'm good today. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Fred. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.